seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Golf Weekly is underway. We are on the radio, Nathan Murphy, as opposed to just podcast form. You are live. That brings with a certain pressure and responsibility.
Must not curse as often on the podcast. It's like when you're in the corner, the little snug of a pub, and you think the three of you are hilarious. Yeah. And for some reason, you decide to go live on stage at Vicar Street with the act, and everyone goes, nah.
You're not that funny. I can't edit out your career enders here, as wow. I do during the week.
Speak for yourself, Joe. Yeah. Speak for yourself.
So coming up on Golf Weekly today, we will very shortly be making contact with Fionn Davenport, who is the third part of the Holy Trinity.
The brains of the operation.
Some would say. We will be talking Tiger Woods, who missed the cut on Friday, plus six with a 76 on the Friday. We'll hear his thoughts on things. We'll be talking about Padraig Harrington and Rory McIlroy sitting down together with Paul Kimmich, which is really electrified the Sunday paper review.
Very jealous.
I know. Yeah, it's sickening. And GMAC, of course, Greg McDowell, currently ranked 219th in the world, is two shots off the lead heading into the final round of the Genesis Open at Riviera. And we'll talk Rory McIlroy, who missed the cut last week at Pebble Beach, but is on level par today at a 73 yesterday. Padraig Harrington is two over. So all of that to come. Shane Lowry missed the cut as well. We'll touch on Shane Lowry, who's 69th in the world now. And Fionn Davenport, I'm told you're now there. Hello.
Hey.
You're live on the air.
Oh, okay.
And your Skype is not working.
It's not my Skype. I think it's your Skype.
Oh no, our Skype works regularly all the time with various contributors from around the world. It is very much, my friend, your Skype.
Wow. All right. Well, I apologize.
That's okay. I'm going to get to tweets as usual. Firstly, so Joe Tallon was in touch. He said a couple of days ago, excited to get my weekly dose of at Golf Weekly OTB, especially after spotting at Malloy Joe and at Nathan Murph chatting over a coffee in Starbucks on Thursday evening. Imagine my shock to discover at Malloy Joe has time for a Tai Chi latte, but not for at Golf Weekly OTB diehards. Hashtag friend of the pod.
Ooh, he's right there, eh? Is it chia latte? Is that tea?
It was an Americano.
Okay.
It's also disconcerting to know that Joe Tallon was sitting there watching us.
Did you have the same thought as I had when you saw that tweet, which was, oh God, what were we saying?
Well, there's always that too, but it's just disconcerting to know that he was there.
Yeah, come over and say hello.
Beady-eyed, looking at us.
Don't be eavesdropping.
Come over and just say hi. So we told Joe Tallon.
That's since you've gone all TV, people are slightly fearful.
We've told Joe to come over and say hi. I don't know, I'm just not comfortable with that.
Well, you're more a McIlroy, I'm more a Harrington.
So I have four majors and you have three.
Yeah, but I'm more likeable.
Well, Sheelan Strain quoted, Shama Nama Ding Dong is what a fan shouted as Phil Mickelson took a putt, lads. I can't wait to hear at Fionn Davenport damning appraisal of such shite on at Golf Weekly OTB. Did you hear the fan Fionn shouting Shama Nama Ding Dong to Phil Mickelson?
I did, actually. And the funny thing was is that I had Twitter open as I was watching. So I saw or heard the fan shout. I saw Mickelson's, I was kind of like, you know, that professional reaction where he kind of acknowledges that there's a SOB in the crowd and then just proceeds. And I was thinking, and I actually thought to myself, oh my God, this is exactly what happens when you parade the Phoenix Open as the future of anything. And literally 45 seconds later, I look at Twitter and I saw that tweet and it just made me laugh.
I didn't see it myself.
No, but there's been a lot of that.
Yeah. Well, interesting, and we'll get on to it. Rory McIlroy was talking about the experience of playing with Tiger at Riviera and was saying he needed headache tablets afterwards because the crowds were just so much. And that one of the annoying things that fans were doing was as Tiger was lining up putts, they were shouting, it doesn't break as much as you think, because they'd been there all day and had seen the various putts breaking in different ways.
I'm surprised that doesn't happen more often. Yeah. I wonder that when I'm at tournaments myself. If you're sitting by the 18th all day, you probably know better than anybody.
Yeah, everyone's missed it. A cup left, they could shout on.
Is there a rule against that? Because I often think, say the final day of the Masters.
Caddies all watch TV coverage in the morning.
Exactly, yeah. But could you have a second caddy, who's maybe sitting on some of the more difficult greens all day, and when you get up there just has a quick word. Yeah, I've seen this putt already. breaks further left than you think.
Well, I mean, anything's possible. We've seen cheating on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Fionn.
It's absolutely true.
That was 20 years ago.
I know, but it's still the shock when you can hear the coughs. I mean,
this is the cost. This is the, I would argue, this is the inevitable consequence of a celebrity culture gone absolutely stone mad, where you have, you know, people who are imbibing of the nectar of the gods. They attend the golf course, and they know that if they shout clearly enough, they will be heard on television, and that then somehow in their own circle they'll be, you know, celebrities for a short while, and completely oblivious to the fact that every single other person watching or hearing thinks that you are the worst person in the place.
Martin Shoaga said, lads, for your intro, Tiger definitely dropped an F-bomb on the 7th, so you can replace the "you suck" in the intro. Thank you, Martin. And Derek Maher retweeted Jason Sobel. He says, Derek Maher, this is the most Dustin Johnson quote ever. The quote from Jason Sobel was, Dustin Johnson on his world ranking and how much he pays attention to it. I look at them on Monday, usually. I still don't understand it, but I can read one. To be fair, no one understands it. Over 700,000 people, says John Cusack, attended the Waste Management Open, but how many paid, he wonders. All service members get free admission. What's a service member?
Somebody who served in the army.
Okay.
Or the navy, or the military.
Of course, yeah. All service members get free admission. How many can that be? Any tournament can get a crowd bump if they don't charge in and let people drink like fish on Super Bowl weekend. I don't know, 700,000 is still a lot.
Yeah, I think you're getting 20,000 a day, maybe with the freebies, but 700,000. We touched on it last week. The strange thing with the Phoenix Open in terms of numbers is, on the final day, Super Bowl day, the numbers completely collapse.
Yeah.
So they have over 200,000 on the Saturday, and the Sunday when it's all 60. Up for 60,000.
Yeah. Somebody was in touch to say, at Golf Weekly OTB, a touch of class with Paul McGinley on the pod last week. That was you, Nathan. I haven't heard that yet. I heard it was good, though.
He was very good on McIlroy and Tiger.
Right. He says, this person, if you're needing someone, though, to improve the overall hair class for the new Facebook Live output, just give me a shout. I, full stop, am, full stop, delicious, full stop. And that is from at Mark Rose Hair. Which continues to amaze. It has its own Twitter handle, Mark Rose Hair, now.
Wow. Yeah, that's something special.
It's luscious. So Ian Kane says, coverage of the Pebble Beach Pro-Am by CBS was nearly as bad, or if not worse, than the coverage of the PGA Championship by BBC. Well, first of all, nothing was as bad as the coverage of the PGA Championship by BBC. The coverage of Pebble Beach by CBS, anyone want to jump in?
I would just argue that it was the opposite of the BBC coverage of the PGA. So the problem with the BBC coverage was, firstly, they weren't there, and also they were treating run-of-the-mill, well, decent PGA Tour players as if nobody had ever heard of them and had no realization of anything they had ever achieved.
Is this because they anticipate with the Bill Murrays of the world playing that there'll be a casual golf audience tuning in, so they're dumbing down?
No, well, I actually felt that they spent too much time going in-depth onto Bill Murray's golf game.
Well, Patrick Flynn says, I never want to see another Bill Murray film again. Pebble Beach coverage is Groundhog Day every year. Mm. It's a lot on Bill Murray. I mean, they sort of, Tiger Woods and Bill Murray, Fionn, are like the lifelines for golf.
Well, as I said last week on the pod, you know, Bill Murray passed a sell-by date about 25 years ago. So, you know,
that's,
he shows
true.
Up at clownish.
Lost in Translation.
Lost in Translation was a peak.
Oh yeah, that was pretty good, actually. No, but I mean, you know, and here's the thing. Okay, first of all, Bill Murray's a committed golfer. He's actually a pretty good golfer, judging by the swings that you see at the Pro-Am. You know, he gets up and down out of bunkers. Do you know what it is? It's all the clowning around. It's just so tired. It's so boring. And one of the problems is that because they're playing on three different courses, so CBS don't have the means, or certainly don't want to spend the money to camera up all three courses. So what you had is, coming in to Saturday evening, you had the leader playing on Monterey Peninsula, but all of the cameras are on Pebble Beach. So you're watching, you know, John, or whatever it is, Jason Day, you're watching a bit of whoever it is that was doing okay, but you're missing out on all the leaders playing on the other course. So it's such a weird way. It's, do you know what it is? It's a bit like watching live golf. It's a bit like actually being at a tournament, but you're sat on your couch watching it on television. You have no idea what's going on the leaderboard unless the leaderboard actually flashes up on the screen. And so it was an incredibly annoying experience. And this experience, the event that's on right now, is only half as annoying, but it's still unbelievably annoying. I think there's a real problem with the way Americans are showing golf at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you know what's extremely frustrating? And some Golf Weekly listeners are lethal for this. When we're having what we feel is a semi-private conversation on our podcast, you know, obviously a lot of people listen, but yeah. I didn't think it goes around the world. And you maybe make a few critical comments of the coverage of Kenny G. And then three or four Golf Weekly listeners decide to tweet at Kenny G. Oh. Telling them what's been said.
They're the worst people who do that.
Why would you do that? Kenny G doesn't want to know. No, he's good about his life, blown his trumpet, delighted with himself.
There's a cabal of people whose life mission is to listen for criticism of other people or anything which might cause any kind of Twitter fight for their own amusement and then tag in that person to make sure they know all about it.
But nobody wants to know.
No. Kenny G definitely didn't care what you guys thought.
But he hasn't got back yet.
No kidding. Shane Russell points out, wow, at Golf Weekly OTB has gone really fancy now. It's accompanied by video. I'm not sure it's possible for Fionn Davenport to look any younger, though. # friend of the pod. And Stephen Tower, Dustin Johnson, lads, 330 yards with a 3-iron. The game is gone. And Damien McCauley, final tweet for the time being. Just a small point on Ballyliffin, which is hosting the Irish Open this year, being this remote, out of the way, sparsely populated part of the country with little infrastructure, including hotel rooms and airports. Lads, it's a 35-minute drive out of Derry, the fourth biggest city on the island, with hotels and an airport.
I think we did make that point. So this was, we were talking to Paul McGinley about him taking over the rotation of the Irish Open, and McGinley feels that we'll probably having it been in Port Stewart and then in Ballyliffin, that it'll probably need to come back somewhere a little bit closer to Dublin in 2019. And like everybody said, Ballyliffin is an unbelievable part of the world, but you can't go quite so remote every single time if you're going to keep sponsors happy.
Okay. They are your tweets. We are taking a short ad break and we are back with talk of Tiger and Rory at Riviera. And plus, Harrington and Rory sat down with Paul Kimmich today. We'll touch on that and a few more bits and pieces besides. This is Golf Weekly on the actual radio. You're welcome back to Golf Weekly. It's Nathan and Joe here, and Fionn is on the line. Hello, Fionn, you're still there?
I am indeed.
So, Tiger Woods, we should talk about. He missed the cut at Riviera. Frankly, one of the reasons we did this this weekend, as much as it being an FA Cup weekend, was that we had presumed maybe after his top 25 finish at Pebble Beach. Not Pebble Beach, rather. Tiger played
Torrey Pines.
Torrey Pines, yeah. Top 25 there. That he may well have improved somewhat and be, you know, vaguely in contention. Top 15. Hey, maybe top 10 if things went very well for him at Riviera, even though he's never played brilliantly there. Alas, he missed the cut. Plus 6 with a 76 on Friday. Pete, I think we have some Tiger Woods audio there. Yeah, Pete is looking for it. There we go. Here's some of what Tiger was saying post his Friday missing the cut.
It's nice to be back competing again. And to be able to go out there and play and then practice after each round, that's been nice. Something I haven't done in years. So, you know, keep building. You know, I haven't played golf in years. So I'm starting to come back, and it's going to take a little time. And I am progressing. I'm starting to get a feel for tournament golf again. I just need to clean up my rounds. Today was the first day that I felt bad with the putter and, you know, this year. But I need to miss the golf balls in the correct spots. You know, I was telling Joey all day, I kept missing in the wrong spots. So all the spots you're supposed to not miss it in, I was putting it in. And that was frustrating because I knew where to hit it and I wasn't able to hit it there. And so I need to do some work there and to make sure that I'm hitting the ball in the spots I want to miss it in. My feet feel fine. You know, they're a little bit sore and knees are a little bit sore. But that's just all age.
Yeah. Your feet get sore when you get to a certain age. What's it like, Fionn?
Do you know what it is? Listen, he has to play, well, he only played 2 rounds this week, but, you know, playing 4 at that age?
Yeah, it's tough.
Whew, I play 18 holes and I'm shattered.
Yeah.
Well, do you know what? I mean, I heard a fuller interview. He kind of vaguely touched on things, but we've come to expect Tiger Woods never really to give an insight into what's truly going wrong. Sure, he hasn't played golf in years. Sure, he's missing the ball or he's missing the greens in the wrong spot. Sure, all those things are true. It's the why he's doing it. So he hits 13 of 28 fairways in the 2 days. Now, it's a marginal improvement on what he did at Torrey Pines, where he only hit 17 of 56. But whereas at Torrey Pines, he was blocking shots out to the right, here he was trying to get that cut. So he was aiming down the left, and then he was pull hooking. And so, you know, at Riviera, you play out of the rough, you're dead. You play out from behind the trees, you're doubly dead. What's really worrying, though, I mean, you know, fans of Tiger Woods, including myself, we all know Tiger's driving is always spotty. It's his irons that generally save him, and they didn't at all this week. Yeah, I mean, really poor.
He was leaving a lot of them. He left a few very short. Like he said in a more fuller interview as well, that the hallmark of my career is pin high iron shots. I didn't do that today. He said his wedge game was fine. So, you know, there was a par three where he left the... he seemed to think his wedge game was okay in the main.
Well,
but he did concede his irons were pretty terrible. And on the Friday, you're mentioning off the tee, he hit seven shots to the left. As you said, it just wasn't cutting back for him.
Yeah. I mean, on the ninth on Friday, which is a little, you know, he hits the fairway for just the second time. Like, he's got 136 yards into a green. Like, that's just like you pick a wedge, you blink, you hit, and he dumps it into the bunker. He missed 7 of 8 par threes.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I've ever seen statistics that bad for a Tiger Woods round. Tiger has missed whatever it is, 7 cuts in his career. This was, to illustrate a point. And that's the point, is that Tiger, he's always deliberately kind of steering you away from me. Maybe, you know, because he doesn't want us to prod him too hard on what it is that's really kind of irking him. But it really emphasizes the point that he is nowhere near tournament ready. I mean, not even close. And, you know, and Torrey Pines kind of gave us this idea, and we were all thrilled, and he finished 23rd and all that. But like, Riviera is tight. Riviera requires that you be accurate off the tee. Riviera requires that you hit the greens in the same spots because of these bowl shaped greens.
Yeah.
And he did none of those.
No,
things.
I appreciate that. There are two causes for optimism. One is that he's now going to play the Honda next week. So it's the first time Woods will have played consecutive weeks on tour since 2015. And he talked about being able to practice after his rounds as well. And that's basically the first time he's been able to do that in years. So certainly that big initial hurdle, which is this guy able to play golf again? It seems to have been, for the time being, successfully straddled. The second point is, and again, it's another cause for optimism, he has never played Riviera well, by his own admission. He hasn't played there in a long time. In tournament golf, anyway, he's played there, he says, socially. But it's not a course that's ever suited him. He's never been massively accurate off the tee. And so you take that and you take the fact that his health seems pretty good. And there was the top 23 or the 23rd finish at Torrey Pines a couple of weeks ago. And we'll get to it, Roy McIlroy and Harrington both feeling, Nathan, that you know, this guy will be top 5 in the betting, potentially justifiably so, ahead of the Masters. I still, even though he's missed a cut, kind of think I'm more than happy with this for his second outing and with the Honda to come next week.
Yeah, the overwhelming positive is that physically he looks as though he'll be able to get through an entire season.
Yeah.
Now, I do wonder mentally where he'll be in 3-4 months' time if he doesn't start seeing some improvements. It does feel as though he only has one aspect of his game to improve. I understand what Fiona's saying, that the stats say his short game really let him down this week as well, but you'd have to wonder how much of that is because he's having such problems with the driver and off the tee that it's just getting him down and it's distracting from everything else completely. The problem for Tiger, and probably the conundrum that he faces, is so he needs to fix his driving. He's going from Riviera to the Honda Classic, which are probably two of the best pointers of the entire year in terms of the majors, in terms of the difficulty of the courses. They're not the type of places where you want to iron out your mistakes, where you just want to get the job done around there. And does that shatter his confidence? He probably feels he needs to push himself physically to show that he can play 2 weeks in a row. But actually, is it the best thing to do? And again, if he takes a week off, what's he doing during that week off? Is he spending too much time in the gym? He doesn't have a coach.
Yeah.
Who's he talking to? Who's he listening to? Is he spending enough time figuring out what's going wrong? And on McIlroy and Harrington saying that they think he's going to go and finish top five or win a major again or contend for a major.
Yeah, both that, said he'd win, they both said they see him winning a major again.
That's not a story. That's not going to be front page of Golf Channel or golf.com tonight. Rory McIlroy or Patrick Harrington saying Tiger's never going to win a major again.
Mm.
Probably is.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that they're... I think they probably realise that the easier thing to say is, I think Tiger's going to go and win again.
It's terribly interesting territory as well if you're... You know, Woods is this historical figure in the game, so we're all massively interested in his journey. One of the really interesting things now is this guy who's worked with Butch Harmon and Hank Haney and Sean Foley and Chris Como most lately... is now trying to figure this out on his own. Like, it will be another facet of the amazing comeback story if he actually manages to sort his game out on his own. And so I'm really curious to see what happens when Woods has this two-day spread where on Thursday he was missing right and left, but Friday it was very much left. Is he now able to go to a driving range on his own and figure out why he was double-crossing himself or why the ball wasn't cutting back and sort that out? I mean... you'd think he must be able to, but it's going to be very interesting to see how he gets on figuring out on his own.
But has he shown that in other aspects of his life? So, say physically, we all thought that actually Tiger was looking a little bit slimmer, that there wasn't quite as much muscle mass there.
Yeah.
Whereas now you look at him again, you're thinking, there's a guy who's spending a lot of time in the gym.
Now
everything suggests that he needs to give his body a break.
Yeah.
But also, he can't seem to work that out by himself. And yeah. I'm sure he's getting a lot of advice as well on telling him what to do.
Yeah. One other aspect of... Tiger is like the, it's like the Beatles arriving in America all over again. There's a huge swathe of people who just want to see him play in the flesh one more time. And that, like, the players are like that as well. But the crowds apparently over those 2 days at Riviera were absolutely insane. Ticket sales went up 60% when he announced he was playing. And McIlroy Fionn was saying, I swear, playing in front of all that, Tiger is giving up half a shot a day on the field.
Yeah.
Like, it's two shots a tournament he has to give to the field because of all that goes on around. Just the whole thing. You've got a 6 foot putt and guys are saying, it doesn't break as much as you think, Tiger. Just stuff like this that they don't have to say. It's tiring, McIlroy said. I need a couple of Advil just to ... Well, I've got a headache after all of that. It doesn't even sound like McIlroy, who, you know, is often the star attraction when it comes to crowds. He's not averse to... playing in kind of the full glare of everybody's attention. Even McIlroy was saying, oh my God, this is a bit much.
I wonder, I read the comment and my first thought was like, wow, I guess maybe McIlroy wasn't really around at the height of Tiger. You know, I mean, McIlroy is very much a post-Tiger phenomenon. And so he perhaps wouldn't have been witness to the Tiger mania that we all got used to from whatever it was, from 97 onwards, until certainly 2008 or 9. But it is an interesting thing that, as you pointed out, that he says that he gives up two shots to the field. Now, I wonder, I mean, I'm going to do a little pop psychology. I wonder if Rory McIlroy is thinking, geez, if that happened to me, I'd be giving up two shots to the field, because Tiger Woods has been doing this his entire career. And clearly doesn't give up two shots to the field. So
usually they say it's the poor group behind Tiger who really struggle as the crowds abandon them.
Well, what it is, it's the player playing with Tiger Woods. Because crowds, as much as crowds try to be respectful when confronted with the single biggest celebrity in the game, once he's finished putting, everybody starts to move to get that position on the next tee. And so the poor schleb who's putting out for, you know, an absolutely important par is doing it while everyone else is around moving. And I realize that the marshals are going, quiet, please, quiet, please. And Tiger, in fairness to him, has always been mindful of, certainly of the etiquette of golf, if not necessarily friendly with anybody. But that notwithstanding, I think it's the guys playing with Tiger who suffer, not Tiger himself.
Mm. We should mention the state of play in the tournament itself now. So that's Tiger who's missed the cut, but the lovely news is he's back in 4 or 5 days' time and we get to see if he's figured things out.
To kind of add to the point, I absolutely agree with your reasons for optimism. I'd also add is that, I mean, one of the things that Tiger said is that, like, look, more than anything, what this experience has shown him is that he needs tournament play under his belt. Now, we all know that. There's nothing... you know, nothing surprising there, but adding Honda to the schedule is just part of that build-up, because you know he's not saying it right now, but you know he wants to go into Augusta giving himself the best possible chance to contend, if not, as Harrington and McIlroy say, finish top five.
So Graeme McDowell then, he's just two shots off the lead heading into the final round. He's amongst a group who are on 8 under. There's four of them. He had a 70 yesterday. Bubba Watson shot a 65 last night. So he leads the field on 10 under. He's one clear of Patrick Cantlay. I mean, what's great about watching Bubba Watson now is they have the Pro Tracer on most of his shots. So of all the golfers in the world, Bubba Watson is the one
that boy can shape a ball.
Oh my God, who needs Pro Tracer the most? It's just unbelievable. So, like, it was just a joy last night. They really did a great job on the coverage of, yeah. I mean, the coverage, we criticised it a fair bit, but of slow motion shots and how he's manipulating the club with his hand. And then, with obviously, off the tee, he'll hit this giant slice. And I use the word slice deliberately. And then with his irons, he'll hit a hook. And the Pro Tracer, that line where you get to watch it all is amazing. He's fallen outside the top 100.
Mm. He hasn't won in 2 years since he won this tournament. He started playing with the pink ball. He started...
Which is crap.
Which was crap. And started indulging in a lot of other stuff outside of golf and seemed to get slightly distracted, yeah. Which is probably fits in with his personality where he struggles to keep any form of concentration. But when he's on his game, again, you wouldn't be surprised if Bubba won the Masters.
I know. I mean, he's got two of them already. So GMAC opened up this year with like three cuts. Mm. And you look at it... So 2016, GMAC was 64th in the world. End of 2016, he was 81st. And then 2017 was a horrific year where he dropped to 4th. So 16-17 has been really, really bad for Graeme McDowell, who is now 38 years old. He's currently 219 in the world. Mm. This is a return to form you couldn't really have foreseen.
No, and heading into this week, GMAC was 150th in driving distance on the PGA Tour. Now, you could look at some of the other players, like Dustin Johnson is outside the top 40, which probably...
In driving distance.
Which would suggest that actually Dustin Johnson's game management has changed completely.
He's just not hitting driver.
That he's not hitting driver as much. Wow. So in terms of being able to hit it as long as anybody, DJ is still up there in the top 5, top 10. But actually, he's just pulling out the three, but he's hitting the more sensible shot.
Interesting.
You probably look at McDowell at 150th and think, that's him at full whack.
Yeah.
That's as far as he can hit it. And you would wonder if that'll catch up with him tonight when you're trying to put pressure on.
Yeah.
He simply can't do that. He can't take any risks. Every shot is all out.
Well, he's all out and he has to be super accurate. Like, he hit 21 of 28 fairways over the first 2 days. So he was number one in that department. So that's, you know, it's hard to be number one for accuracy when you're actually ripping at the ball within your own ability. But that's kind of interesting that GMAC is back. I mean, it kind of felt over the last 2 years feeling like the game was passing him by distance wise. As sorry to interrupt, this is sacrilege on the Golf Weekly podcast, but Nathan, we should tell people about a big FA Cup goal.
Yeah, Rochdale bottom of League One have just gone 1-0 up against Spurs.
There you go.
Whew, magic of the cup, eh?
Magic is alive and well.
Greatest cup tournament in the world.
So
well, I mean, Jim, he'd argue, and he's right to say so, that, I mean, you pointed out the perilous fall outside of, never mind the top 100, the top 200 in the world. But, you know, he had a family, two kids, well, he had a second child born, and he's been devoting a huge amount of time to his business interests, his Nona Blue restaurant, so on and so forth. So all we all know that. But what's interesting is that he began this season with a renewed commitment to going, look, I want to give my golf the best chance possible. I didn't for the last couple of years. Now, merely saying so, you know, golf is an unforgiving game. Merely wanting it doesn't mean it'll become so. But this week shows that, oh my God, you know, Graeme McDowell, who definitely took his eye off the golfing ball for the last couple of years, if he starts to apply himself, can actually start to contend in a select number of events, because look, he's not the longest, as you just pointed out, but Riviera doesn't benefit super, super long hitters anyway, because you don't want to be taking driver out of these super narrow fairways. You want to keep the ball in play, which really suits a McDowell. Now, I take your point that he is hitting to the edge of his limit, so whatever he's going, 268, he's off the tee or whatever it is. And so, but when you look at that swing of his, you know, which is truncated, little three-quarter, with a super aggressive follow-through, but he puts the ball in play. Now, that all said, he hasn't been here for quite a while. I mean, his last win is 2015, the Mayakoba Classic in Mexico. He only hit 7 fairways and 10 greens yesterday. but he really grounded out. Like, he got some great up and downs. He made some solid putts. Irrespective of what happens today, and if you were to ask me to put money on it, I don't think G-Mac's going to win, but I think he's going to put in a decent enough showing to give him confidence going into the rest of the season.
Okay. So
before you move on,
yeah,
Joe,
go on.
So Riviera this week, Hogan's Alley, one of the most famous golf courses in the world.
Humphrey Bogart's tree.
For once in my life, I've done some research. So I'm going to get it out there. It's the last thing I do. So I asked the question last night.
Yeah.
Is Riviera Country Club the most valuable piece of sporting real estate in the world?
Because it's right in the heart of
It's a block south LA. Of Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
And quite a few of the responses said, check out Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History podcast where he talks about this.
Yeah.
So I did just that. Now, Gladwell's attitude to golf is revealed pretty quickly in the podcast.
This episode is about the problem with golf. I hate golf. And hopefully, by the end of this, you'll hate golf too.
Does he end up liking golf?
No, and you won't end up liking golf by the end of this. So there's quite a few things he looks at. Like, for example, he got a graduate student to look at the CEOs of the top 1,500 publicly listed companies in the USA.
Right.
They tried to find their handicaps, which are publicly available, if they were golfers and how much golf they were playing. CEOs play a lot of golf.
Yeah.
And top 10% are playing around 37 times a year. Now, they could be playing
That's not that much.
They could be playing on Saturdays.
That's less than once a week.
So it's fine. Yeah. Now, he thinks this is a terrible, terrible thing. But there is a direct correlation between the amount of golf you play and how badly your company is doing. The more you play as a CEO, the worse your company is doing.
Nothing is that simple. There are more than that's
quite a few of them playing
effect,
over three
botched.
Times a week, which means they're definitely taking Fridays off.
No.
So you can't have that.
Can I just...
If Jordan Peterson, Fiona's taught us anything, it's that there's multiple causes for any number of things.
Indeed. 24, usually. But if that stat is true about CEO, the more CEO plays golf, the worse his company or her company is doing. I mean, you could say that Donald Trump is the CEO of his particular
He gives that example on many occasions throughout the podcast.
All right. Okay, well, that makes
And it, is that Riviera makes valuable?
So the history well, of sorry, Riviera and I, the country can, clubs in LA...
For my own sanity, can I rephrase that question? I'm not asking, is Riviera valuable? Is it the most valuable real estate in...
You struggle to get a mortgage to cover the cost of it. So the history of country clubs in LA is quite fascinating in terms of how they can afford to keep going in an area of such prime real estate. And the reason for this is pretty fascinating. So in America, they have a property tax, and the principle behind the property tax is highest and best use. So what that means, as Gladwell explains basically, is if you have an acre of land in the middle of downtown Manhattan and it used to be a vegetable plot, you can't then just keep it as a vegetable plot and tell the city authorities, yeah, it's a vegetable plot, I pay $100 property tax on it a year. They will charge you the property tax based on the highest possible value, which is if you had a 100-story skyscraper.
Okay.
So you're as well to turn it into a 100-story skyscraper, and you get your offices and you get your
capitalism apartments work, yeah.
And all of that. So somehow the country clubs in LA have managed to avoid this. They used Bob Hope back in the 60s,
yeah,
who went to the LA council essentially, and Bob Hope, who was an entertainer to the stars but also friend of the everyman,
sure,
and they sort of looked at Bob Hope and thought, well, if Bob feels this is a good thing,
yeah,
so they managed to get an exemption from that.
All right.
Then there was an introduction of Proposition 13, right, that says that in 1978, that's the cutoff point, if the country club doesn't change hands, if your house doesn't change hands, so if you live in the same house since before 1978, you still pay the same property tax as you paid back then. It never goes up.
Which is every golf course ever.
Now, you could look at it and say, because the way country clubs work, if you're a member, you're one of the owners, and then they all die and new people come through, that maybe it has changed hands. But they've decided, no, that's not the case. So the LA Country Club, which is right beside Riviera, so you could say they're both worth a similar amount, is worth $9 billion.
What?
They reckon it's worth $9 billion. On average, they're about 200 acres, pretty much smack bang in the center of Beverly Hills. Totally,
oh my God,
inaccessible to the public. And this is why Gladwell investigated it, that there's nowhere, basically, no parks in LA for the public to go running around. So they run around the outside of Riviera LA Country Club,
yeah,
basically on the dirt track outside. And he's like, well, we should be allowed in here.
Yeah.
These people. So they should pay, technically, around $90 million in tax every year.
Yeah.
They pay $200,000.
What's his problem with golf, though? What? Right, that's damning.
Rich people should be allowed to relax as well.
Did you hate golf by the end of his podcast?
I just thought I'd really like to go to some of these country clubs.
Probably do a golf podcast, right? Riviera has, obviously, given its location, has a whole bunch of celebrity members. Back in the 90s, O.J. Simpson was one of the members at Riviera, and it was there where he infamously, playing with his partners, that he would hook a ball into the trees, and then one of his partners went in to see had he found his ball and found that he was teeing up his ball for his second shot.
Out of
the rough in amongst the trees. He put the ball on a tee. On a driving tee.
OJ,
not the worst thing he's ever done.
No, I mean, look, I mean, on the scale of things OJ's done, it's probably not the worst. But for such a coordinated, gifted athlete, OJ Simpson must have the most atrocious golf swing. Like, I was staggeringly ugly, the golf swing.
He's a Charles Barkley, isn't he?
One of the worst.
He's not far off it.
He's appalling. But when his playing partner goes, dude, you can't do that. And he goes, yeah, I can. I'm OJ. And that was OJ in golf.
Again, he's potentially gotten away with worse, Fionn.
Has indeed. Well, allegedly, yeah.
Potentially. So
live on the radio becomes a problem.
Yeah. So we'll move off OJ and we will turn to, I suppose, the star attraction in the Sunday Independent today. We can't really miss it. So it's across two pages. I've already had my say in a lot of it on the paper review with Kieran Shannon and Gav Riley earlier today. You can download that as well. So Paul Kimmage, I mean, this is just the it's the dream, and it's the fruition of kind of maintaining relationships with these guys on a one-on-one basis over a couple of years. This wouldn't happen with PR companies or agents. They just wouldn't do it, but he's managed to convince both of them, Harrington and McIlroy, at Riviera to sit down for what seems like a very long interview. It's certainly 2.5 pages of the Sunday Independent today, and to talk about it, the Odd Couple is the headline, and to talk about their relationship with each other, their relationship with golf, with life, with everything, with Trump, with politics. And it's brilliant. It's fascinating. I mean, this will be, when this goes up online very shortly, it will be the toast of the golfing world. All the journalists will be sharing it. They won't believe that, you know, the two boys with their 7 majors have sat down and talked about life so openly. It's really fantastic. I know you've both read it, so you can jump off on any point. We won't get to cover everything because there's about 30 million gems in it and our time is limited.
I think The Odd Couple is a good headline because it didn't strike me during this that they were actually particularly close. So I even heard you talking about it during the pay-per-view. So as they went back, actually, it turned out there were times they were together, but like they never touched on a Ryder Cup when they were in the same dressing room as having any sort of bond there at all. And like Rory, firstly, doing an interview with Harrington, you're always going to be overshadowed. Like, the man is a genius. We must have had him on this show, 4 times in the last year in a variety of different guises, from doing the piece with him in his house, having him in the pay-per-view, straightforward interviews, and every time you go, oh, I really want to talk to Harrington again. There's so much more you want to ask him.
Yeah.
And he is by far the more interesting, even if he is with Rory McIlroy, who we don't hear from quite as much. Even the stuff Harrington saying, I love fame. I love walking down Grafton Street and people shouting my name. The piece I liked was, he seems to be at an interesting part of his career where, because he's not contending for tournaments, he almost, it seems as though he's decided, I'm going to enjoy this for what it is. And was it Harrington who said before, you know, you're away, you're in, this week they're in LA and your wife rings you up and you almost have to go to the room and say, yeah, it's terrible. Oh, I'm really down. It's terrible. I'm just not enjoying myself at all. Yeah, it's a real old grind. Right. Whereas actually he seems to have decided now, you know what, I'm going to go out, I'm going to enjoy this. And then the guilt of his children at a really good age, where he could be at home spending time with them. He doesn't necessarily need the money of being out on tour. He knows he's not going to contend every week, and trying to weigh up that balance of, well, what am I doing here? I don't think he fully answers that, as to maybe that's the reason why he's decided, above all else, I'm going to have a good time. I'm going to share the house with Shane Lowry, I'm going to enjoy my week, and if I win, I win. But I need to have something to cling on to, that if I'm spending weeks on end away from home.
Yeah, I'll bring you in just a second here, Fionn, but on that point, because it's in my head, that direct point led on to a very interesting exchange where Harrington's talking about being worried about 4 or 5 years, regretting the time spent on tour now and not with his family. And Kimmage picks up on that and says, well, what do you worry about, Rory? And McIlroy gives this very, just this blunt answer, again, he's brilliant with the media. Actually, it's interesting, at one point Harrington doesn't think Rory's good with the media, thinks he's cold. I think that's totally wrong. I don't know how much media Harrington's consuming of Rory, but I would never say he's not good in the media. I wouldn't even think he's cold in the media either, Rory. But McIlroy's answer is, I worry about how much longer my parents will be around. And Harrington's reaction is almost, whoa, like literally says the word whoa. And McIlroy says, yeah, that'd be it. And Harrington then confesses, well, look, my mother wouldn't like me mentioning this, but that's my worry too with her. So actually, right throughout the piece, there are moments where they reveal something of themselves to us all, but also to each other, because you suspect they haven't talked in depth over dinner after dinner at length. That's the nature of their relationship. Like, even Harrington is astounded at one point when McIlroy Fionn knows the last time he played in Memphis, and knows, he says, the winner of every tournament, where it was, the year, the course, basically ever. Like, mentions a match with Harrington and Woosnam, which Harrington can't remember. He can't remember the year, and McIlroy's like, yeah, it was 2001, and Harrington's kind of blown away. And I must say, that sort of struck me, because I always had Rory down as very dedicated to his own craft and his own game and a hard worker, but I never had him down as the guy who cared who won the Memphis Open in 2014.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, is that Rory is a kind of a golf nerd, you know, in the sense that he kind of keeps an eye on stats and can tell you, like, you know, the guy who can tell you every single FA Cup winner going back to 1927.
Well, he's a self-confessed golf nerd. He has said this before, and he's never, you never really get a chance to prove it. He'll often say, I could tell you who's won every Masters going back to the 60s. And you just love to go, yeah, who won the 72, and just see if he can test it.
I think for me, and I take your point about the stuff about his parents. I mean, maybe I'm at an age where my parents are at an age where I am worried about my parents, you know, and I'm conscious that they're not always going to be here. So maybe that will surprise me a little less. But then again, you remind yourself that Rory's not even 30 years old. So for a young man to be thinking like that is actually quite, certainly makes you stop and take pause. The two areas that really struck me was, one is that Harrington definitely kind of said to him, "Is like, you know, you never really hung out with the Irish. You were never really part of the Irish team." And what was interesting is that when Sergio when Rory went to Carnoustie, was at Carnoustie, and Sergio was in battle with Harrington, he kind of says, like, he kind of wanted Sergio to win because Sergio was his guy. Like, he's a young kid. And for his generation, Sergio was the guy that you followed. So that almost as a young man, Rory didn't have like kind of national blinkers on. And I mean that in a very kind of positive sense, you know, that he was able to kind of just pick his favorite player. And then I think when he said this to Kimmage, Harrington was out answering a phone call. Yeah. And then Harrington comes back in, but doesn't seem in any way surprised or perplexed by this. He goes, yeah, because Sergio's your generation. I thought that was a very interesting observation. And then the second one that I found almost the most interesting thing in the entire 2.5-page piece was Rory's talking about his struggles to be normal. Now, we know that he has addressed this before, but that the way he talked about, there was a point where he's talking about, like, well, you know, how do you judge whether people are good people or bad people? He goes, well, he was very nice to me. And Rory goes, but everybody is nice to me. Mm. Everybody is nice to me because I'm Rory McIlroy. And so invariably he is surrounded by sycophants, and and so that struggle to, one, separate himself from the yes men and the yes women of his world, and to surround himself with a core of people, I'm assuming his wife Erica, his father Jerry are key to this, having Diamond on the bag, who's a friend of his going back years. Like, these are the people, and this is a fame issue that Harrington's never really had to deal with to the same degree. And I thought it was really insightful. I mean, I take your point that Harrington generally opens his mouth and is just interesting. But if I was to pick of the two, I thought Rory was by far the more interesting person in this article, because there was nothing surprising about Harrington. Harrington was his brilliant self. Whereas I thought Rory revealed an awful lot more than he has done even in the past. And that would have been my kind of main take home.
The thing that struck me more than anything else with Rory was how he seems to be living a life of isolation in golf, which I was quite surprised by. So Rory's been something, don't know, a serial monogamist. Like, he throws himself into his relationships, which, here, it's a great thing. And he has a life outside of golf. I didn't realise, though, quite how isolated he seemed to have become. So he spoke about going for dinner with the Snedekers, not because himself and Brandt are particularly close, but because his wife Erica and Snedeker's wife are particularly close. And here, there's nothing wrong with that at all. But when he was pushed on, well, you know, who are you close to in golf?
Yeah.
It was Ollie Fisher.
But, now, but even...
Even then, I'd say if you said, when did you last speak to Ollie Fisher?
Yeah, and even then he gave a long pause. Mm. And Kimmage said, I'll take that as a no. And it was only later on when Fisher came up that Harrington went, oh yeah, you're close with Fisher. You've known him a long time. And Rory was like, oh yeah, 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 Ollie Fisher. But actually, if you can't think of him when you're asked who you're close with, you can't be that close.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, who's your mate? And then you don't think of someone until you see them. They're not that close a mate.
And this is the problem when you analyse Rory, because what do you want from your sports stars? We're quite selfish in what we want from our sports stars.
Everything.
We want everything, and we want them to be brilliant at what they do and obsessed with what they do. Whereas you definitely take from that golf is not the number one thing in Rory's life. His relationship is the number one thing in his life. And I don't think you would say that for any of the other top golfers, many of whom are married, are engaged, or have partners, that right now the leading players are fully focused on their golf. And they're probably thinking down the line, when this passage of time passes and Jordan Spieth, when he gets to 35-40, he goes, that'll be the time for me and you. Mm. But right now, golf is absolutely everything. Where Rory...
It's hard to know. Maybe he feels that like his happiness and... Yeah, hanging out with Erica and the entourage is the way he prepares best for golf. Maybe it's a double-sided coin. Interestingly, actually, you mentioned Spieth. They both talk about how underrated Spieth is, which the golf nerds and all of us, I think, were nodding approvingly that Spieth is just a legend who doesn't get the credit he deserves.
Just one thing, Fiona, before that.
Sure.
Like, it is pop psychology with Rory. We don't know. It's a couple of lines in an article and you're reading a huge amount into it. And again, I actually think he's probably right for his full life, living to 85, 90. That maybe this is the best thing. He has the money, he has the four majors already, but he's said himself at times he's entering a period of life where they're going to be very quickly thinking about having children, and suddenly Erica won't be on tour with him every week. And do you then almost have that tiger-like moment of you arrive at the Honda Classic and you're like, oh, I'm here by myself?
Well, I wanted to pick up on something Nathan said, because I mean of course it's pop psychology. A couple of weeks ago, or at Pebble Beach, or just beforehand, Rory was interviewed. He did the presser, and he was asked a question by one of the journalists, who said that, and the question asked was, Jason Day has said about you that, you know, you've got every single tool in the locker. It says the only question is whether you have the drive, or the, you know, whatever it is, the will. I can't remember the exact word, but it was roughly that. And the way Rory answered the question, now again, I'm applying my interpretive psychology and I'm totally unqualified for this, but that notwithstanding, the way Rory answered was so unconvincing, because he kept saying, yeah, no, the drive is definitely there, the drive is definitely there. And I think that plays into everything that Nathan just said. I think this is a guy who was just, who realized, he's been, you know, he's been in the goldfish bowl since he was 9 years old. I think this is a guy who is struggling to adapt to the demands of being one of the world's highest profile golfers, as well as to the demands of being a person, living his life, getting married, having kids, whatever it is. And I would wager that if Rory was to win one major every 3 years for the rest of his career and throw in a couple of wins every so often, I think Rory would be quite a happy man.
Yeah, that'll get him close to 10 majors though, so...
Said himself, he goes, if I won seven, sure, he said recently, if I won seven, he used to say, oh, if I want to win double digits. Like, his numbers are getting lower and lower, and not because Rory thinks, oh, I'm not good enough. I think because, and again, I would love a journalist, I wish Paul Kimmage would have asked him this question, but I would love for someone to go, like, do you have that desire to hit 1,000 putts on the putting green every day, to devote 8-9 hours a day of practice the way, well, you know, Tiger Woods did.
Not to interrupt, but interestingly, that does come up in a way, certainly, where McIlroy is quite upfront about the fact that he looks at Harrington at Harrington's age and pretty much says, I don't think I could practice with his intensity at his age.
Yeah.
I just find it too draining. So that automatically, that doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't have the drive now, because I think he is quite driven now, but... Maybe there's a very mature awareness on his part that his drive is a more finite resource than it is in the case of Harrington, that he is on borrowed time is a slightly clumsy way of putting it, and he knows that at some stage, probably before he hits 40, which is now 10 years away, he is going to lose something in the way of desire to go out and practice the way Harrington seems not to have lost it all. So that puts him on very borrowed time.
Well, there is another part in the piece that was interesting where Harrington, where Kimmage asked Harrington what are the two things he admires about Rory, and he goes, well, it's that idea that when his game is on, he's unstoppable.
Yeah.
That when his game is not on, he is very stoppable.
Yeah.
And you could see that, for instance, I was watching Rory over the last couple of days. Now, Rory's walking around and goes, my game isn't there to win. I'm not going to win this weekend. He hit a putt for birdie yesterday. Like, maybe he just got tired. Maybe, you know, like, I know he's been complaining about the Poana greens, but he hit a putt that was so lacking in attention and so lacking in concentration that you could see it was like, all right, is this Rory kind of going, all right, I'm kind of here making up numbers now. I'm going to kind of try, but I'm not really. I mean, look, I'm kind of reading his mind. But do you know what I mean? It was like there was a sense of like, I don't think Rory has that, you know, that Tiger drive where it's like, I'm going to turn a 76 into a 73. I'm going to turn a 72 into a 69.
Yeah, maybe.
I think Rory today's a 73 day, and that's just the way it is.
Maybe. That's probably where we have to, again, flag we're not inside the guy's mind.
And sure,
there is a reality for all golfers that they are different beasts when they're in contention and adrenaline is pumping. And, like, it's hard, even for the recreational golfer, it's a pain in the ass when you're completely out of a tournament to bring the same focus. So maybe there's a bit of that. Yeah. There's about a billion things in that article we haven't even touched on, from them talking about the wedding to Donald Trump to, at one point, Harrington very happy with his own hairline saying to Rory, what's underneath your cap there? And I think that's that receding a little bit. Think it might be.
Yeah.
There's great stuff in it. We might try and we'll try maybe twist Paul Kimmage's arm to come on the golf pod next Thursday and even get his read on body language and all those kind of juicy little bits. But for now, we are done. Golf Weekly on the radio. Fiona's coming to an end. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, lads.
And Nathan Murphy, thank you as ever.
Cheers, Joe.
We are back in just a moment. Oh,